Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world, ever,
ever.
M is for The Man Who Sold the World.
Whoa, one of my favourite Bowie albums. So the personnel, David Bowie, vocals, guitar, stylophone, organ, saxophone.
Mick Ronson, guitars, backing vocals.
Tony Visconti, bass guitar, piano, guitar, recorder, producer, backing vocals.
Mick Woody Woodmansey, drums, percussion.
Ralph Mace, Moog, modular synthesizer.
And Ken Scott, engineer. Now, John Cambridge was the original drummer on the record, but he couldn't nail certain parts of the songs, particularly but the wild bit in the Superman. Couldn't he? So Bowie told Cambridge they were letting him go, not because of his drumming, because they wanted to bring somebody in who could help with the arrangements. There was a quote from John Cambridge, wasn't it? I know we'd done him in J, but he said, "I couldn't get it right." And even Mick Ronson was saying, "Come on, it's easy. It makes you feel even worse."
Yeah, that's loads of pressure, isn't it? And the funny thing is, I mean, I don't know how well Woody Woodmansey is known for his arrangements. We'll have to ask him, won't we?
I mean,
and you've got what was just the burgeoning genius of arrangements in Mick Ronson as well. So
yeah,
he was a smokescreen. Apparently, John Cambridge could hear Angie Bowie saying to David in another part of the house, "Go and tell him! Go on! Go on! Are you a man or a mouse? Go upstairs and tell him!" So, and that's when he went upstairs and said, "Oh yeah, I think we're going to need an arranging drummer." Which has got to be the worst excuse in the world ever, hasn't it?
Not even musical differences, is it? Didn't he feel so bad he paid him his petrol to get home?
Oh, something like that, yeah.
Anyway, so Mick Ronson ended up suggesting Woody brought in, and it was recorded at Trident Studios, wasn't it? April 1970.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's just set the scene here, right? Okay, so in 1970, so it was a year previous that Bowie had a hit with Space Oddity.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people did view that, including, as we know, Tony Visconti, as a novelty record.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was kind of a bit of a double-edged sword for Bowie and kind of a little bit of a millstone for him in a way. And then he released A Pretty Star with Mark Bolan on guitar.
That's right.
And that was a flop. And so he wasn't in a particularly good place, was he?
No.
So he just got his new place, Haddon Hall, and he had his band move in with him.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, Angie's there. His new wife, Angie, is there because he got married in at the end of March, just as the recording session started, which may have been, well, you know, kind of played into the way it was created, we think, don't we?
It sounds like it, most certainly. And also, really, really hugely important to this is the fact that at Haddon Hall, one of the regular visitors there was his half-brother, Terry,
yeah,
who was actually a voluntary resident at Cane Hill Asylum, which we will look at in a short while. But this is it's a thread that we've mentioned many times before because Bowie mentions it many times throughout his life. The fact that his brother was schizophrenic and was very, very fragile and frail, and Bowie often just questioned as to whether he had anything of a similar kind of a diagnosis to be found.
Yeah,
didn't
he feared he'd go the same way. So as regarding the session, so they built a primitive studio in the basement at Haddon Hall, and they lived on very little money. And they were skint, weren't they? There was a lot of them living there. They ate food often burnt to a cinder by Angie, which is it's a great passage in Woody's book, isn't it? Spider from Mars, where he talks about, you know, this food and how it was, how it was made.
Yeah, it is hilarious, that section of the book. Also, crucially, Bowie was just about still being managed by Kenneth Pitt. And so, Tony DeFreeze is coming over the hill, as we know, to just change Bowie's career completely. So this from Nick Pegg's book, The Complete David Bowie, which is really, really great. But it was originally from Disc and Music Echo, February 1970, As the first side will be completely augmented, it means specially writing a whole new set of material. The second side will be just me with guitar. Oh, will it now, David?
Yeah.
And so Tony Visconti said at the time the intention was for the Man Who Sold the World to be their Sergeant Pepper.
No shortage of ambition then, was there?
Nope.
So the Man Who Sold the World is a third album by Bowie, released in the US by Mercury Records on the 4th of November 1970, and then in April 1971 in the UK, recorded the album with producer Tony Visconti at Trident in London and AdVision in West London. And although author David Buckley has described Bowie's previous record, David Bowie, sort of Stroke Space Oddity, as it's become known, as the first Bowie album proper, Roy Carr and Charles Shaw Murray in The Enemy have said of The Man Who Sold the World, this is where the story really starts. Departing from the largely acoustic music of Bowie's second album, Man Who Sold the World is generally considered, well, a hard rock, heavy metal piece.
It's impossible to really nail what it is. There's a bit of prog in there, and there's definitely metal in there. It's a hybrid album, isn't it?
It is.
So
it is.
Let's look at the writing and recording of it. The album was written and rehearsed at Haddon Hall, Beckenham, an Edwardian mansion converted to a block of flats that was described by one visitor as having the ambience like Dracula's living room. As Bowie was preoccupied with his new wife, Angie, at the time, the music was largely arranged by guitarist Mick Ronson and bassist /producer Tony Visconti. Although Bowie officially is credited as a composer of all the music on the album, biographer Pete Doggett quoted Visconti saying, "The songs were written by all four of us. We'd jam in the basement, and Bowie would just say whether he liked them or not." This is a real bone of contention, isn't it?
It is. So Pete Doggett, in his narrative, he said, "The band, sometimes with Bowie contributing guitar, sometimes not, would record an instrumental track which might or might not be based upon an original Bowie idea." So already we're in nebulous territory here. Then at the last possible moment, Bowie would reluctantly uncurl himself from the sofa on which he was lounging with his wife and dash off a set of lyrics. Despite his annoyance with Bowie's fixation on married life during the recording of The Man Who Sold the World, Visconti still rated it as his best work with Bowie until Scary Monsters in 1980.
So Bowie himself was quoted in 1998 as saying, "I really did object to the impression that I did not write the songs on The Man Who Sold the World. You only have to check out the chord changes. No one writes chord changes like that." This is something that Rick Wakeman famously said, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
When he was running through the piano piece for Life on Mars,
he said,
"Right, okay, there's these chords here. You would expect this chord, but no, Bowie goes here and there and then there." And nobody does that kind of thing. So he's borne out by an absolutely amazing musician in Rick Wakeman.
Yeah,
but you can also say that all the other musicians on the album did stick together and say that they really did have a massive hand in writing the music. So we weren't there, were we?
We weren't.
But Bowie said the Width of a Circle and the Supermen, for example, were already in existence before the sessions began. So Ralph Mace played a Moog modular synthesizer, which was borrowed from George Harrison. And Mace was a 40-year-old concert pianist who was also the head of classical music at Mercury Records.
Wow, okay. So moving on now to the music and lyrics. Much of the album has a distinct heavy metal edge, as we mentioned, that distinguishes it from Bowie's other releases, and it's been compared to acts like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. Of course it has.
Well, understandably, yeah. A thrilling record. And again, you know, we have discussed the fact that when these records got re-released, you know, chronologically all over the shop, then it was just really strange. And the cover work as well, the actual cover of the album, which changed, didn't help. So let's have a look at the different cover artworks, okay? So the original 1970 US release of The Man Who Sold the World employed a cartoon like cover drawing by Bowie's friend Michael J. Weller, featuring a cowboy in front of the Cane Hill Mental Asylum. And we'll have a quick look at that now.
Yeah, we will.
But we're going to have a look at the covers before we go into that, Bob, I think. I've got them all.
I can see them. You brought them here.
Yeah, so that, you have to say, the actual cartoon version, which we just discussed there, is pretty rubbish.
It's not the best, is it?
It's the cowboy in it is supposed to be John Wayne, isn't it?
That's right. It's a still of John Wayne with his sort of with his rifle sort of at his side, and that was used as a template for that. And then you can see a cartoon drawing of Cane Hill in the background. I mean, there's no indication. If you looked at that cover, you didn't know anything about Bowie. There's nothing in that would suggest the kind of music that was contained within it.
No, I mean, that looks almost like a kind of tongue-in-cheek, one of the maybe Top of the Pops albums, it's very of its time and all that, but there's also a cartoon on the back of what looks like, you know, there's a woman there, look like in a dancing outfit, there's a bloke with dungarees and a flat cap, and another guy in a suit. And they're all saying, "Oh, by jingo." I mean, Random doesn't even cover it, does it?
I mean, to me, it looks like one of those sort of budget, you know, sampler releases that used to be all the rage, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and the way that Dave David Bowie has written is quite, I like it, but it just doesn't give you the sense of foreboding that you would find if you actually opened up the record and played it.
Not at all.
And so it was followed, and we'll go into all this, but we'll talk about it now because I've got it here, the original dress cover. Some people call it the drag cover, don't they? This is an original version of it, which is obviously one of my pride and joys. But
so you've not let me really have a proper look at that, have
no.
you? Because I don't have an original version of that, which change hands for a lot of money these days.
They do. They go for about, I don't know, is it about $1,500 or something like that? I mean, as we know, the David Bowie kind of, the prices of his material just went through the roof when he passed away. Yeah. And not least this, you know, it's a hugely collectible album. And if you want to know whether you're buying the right one or not, then this the Matrix on the run out of the record, the proper one is stamped, the one that is a bootleg, and it has been well bootlegged, this is just written in hand. And there's some other various flaws in the even the original ones. They spell Tony Visconti wrong on the original pressing, I think.
Oh,
that's
do
the
they?
Way.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Something like that. But also the texture of the sleeve is all a bit spottish, but the texture of the sleeve will let you know as to whether it's original or not.
Wasn't there something as well to do with the way it was, the photograph was cropped? Wasn't it cropped slightly differently to the original bona fide stuff?
Yeah, I think that they had to blow it up slightly just to be able to nick the image. And so I think some of the is it a frame? Yeah, the frame, the silver frame there on the corner. I think there's a little bit less of that on the bootleg. And then we go over to the German release of it, which is on the floor here, which you're looking at, and it looks like a very large beer mat. But don't use it as one because it's very, very collectible. And it is strange. It's Bowie's, again, an illustration of Bowie with blue hair. So predating Molly Sugden in Are You Being Served?
Just about, I think, yeah.
Just about. Yeah. But Bowie's head is attached to a big hand which is about to flick the Earth off into space, and he's also got some blue, yellow and purple wings.
Yeah, it's a great image, very striking indeed.
It is. Again, I don't know what it means. It almost looks Monty Python-esque, doesn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
He looks very Terry Gilliam, actually,
very much so, yeah. And also on the back, you've got a sort of black and white photo of Bowie, haven't you, with his beret on and his overcoat. And the
rest. All that, taken from the same sessions as the other. The version of the album, and then the album that most of us will first have been aware of, which is the one with what we call a kicking cover, which is a picture of Bowie, and obviously he's kicking,
in his Ziggy Stardust phase, of course, because that was reissued in 72,
on the back of the success of Ziggy Stardust. Yeah. So that is it. But going back to the first one, as you say, it's got John Wayne on the front. Go figure. And he is in front of the asylum, and the asylum being Cane Hill.
Yeah.
So let's have just a quick look at that, because it is pertinent for things that we mentioned earlier on.
It is. All right. So Cane Hill. So, of course, as mentioned before, this is where Terry, David's half-brother, was a patient. The hospital had its origins in the 3rd Surrey County Pauper Lunatic Asylum, designed by Charles Henry Howell, built in two stages between 1882 and 1888. A design which involved a radiating pavilion layout was original, and the hospital was taken over by London County Council in 1889. The hospital itself took in a large number of discharged mentally ill servicemen during the First World War, the earliest patient recorded there being admitted in 1915.
So on the 13th of November 2010, a fire took hold in the administration block and went on to destroy all but the front facade of the building. The fire also destroyed the iconic clock tower, which is seen on the album.
Yeah.
At about midnight, firefighters saw the clock tower crash to the ground in the blaze. The fire had been started in the basement of the building, drafting its way up through the ground and first floors before finally destroying the roof.
Wow, so, you know, convoluted history.
Yeah, okay.
So let's get back to the cover, shall we?
Yeah.
So Michael Weller, whose friend was a patient there, suggested the idea after Bowie had asked him to create a design that would capture the music's foreboding tone. Drawing on pop art styles, he depicted a dreary main entrance block to the hospital with a damaged clock tower, as discussed. And, you know, for the design's foreground, he used that picture of John Wayne, as a template for a cowboy figure wearing a 10-gallon hat and a rifle, which was supposedly meant as an allusion to the song Running Gun Blues.
Yeah, and I don't recall Running Gun Blues particularly being about a cowboy.
No.
So Bowie suggested Weller incorporate the exploding head signature on the cowboy's hat, a feature he'd previously used on his posters while a part of the arts lab. He also added an empty speech balloon for the cowboy figure, which was intended to have the line, "Roll up your sleeves and show us your arm," which is a pun on record players, guns and drug use.
Right.
But Mercury, the label, found the idea too risque and the balloon was left blank.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
According to Bowie's biographer, Nicholas Pegg, at this point, David's intention was to call the album Metropolis, a play on Fritz Lang's Metropolis. The title would remain on the tape boxes even after Mercury had released the album in America as The Man Who Sold the World. And Bowie was enthusiastic about the finished design, but he soon reconsidered the idea and had the art department at Philips, which was a subsidiary of Mercury, wasn't it, enlist photographer Keith McMillan to shoot an alternative cover.
Okay, so this is a dress sleeve. Mm-hmm. The shoot took place in a domestic environment, which was Haddon Hall, in the living room, where Bowie reclined on the chaise longue in a cream and blue satin man's dress, which we had previously discussed, an early indication of his interest in exploiting his androgynous appearance. The dress was designed by British fashion designer Michael Fish. It has also been said that his bleached blonde locks, falling below shoulder level in the photo, were inspired by a pre-Raphaelite painting by Dante Gabriel Rossetti.
Ooh, so in the US, Mercury rejected Macmillan's photo and released the album with Weller's design as its cover instead, much to Bowie's displeasure, apparently, although he successfully lobbied the label to use the photo for the record's release in the UK. In 1972, he said that Weller's design was horrible, but reappraised it in 1999, saying he actually thought the cartoon cover was really cool. And while promoting The Man Who Sold the World, of course, in the US, Bowie wore the Mr. Fish dress in February 71 on his first promo tour and during interviews, despite the fact the Americans had no knowledge of the as-yet-unreleased UK cover.
Yeah, and also we've documented the fact that when he went over to America and he was wearing his man's dress, they wouldn't let him into some restaurants in clubs, would they?
No.
And he got called all names. Quite a brave thing to do, actually.
Definitely.
So the 1971 German release, talked about, presented a winged hybrid creature with Bowie's head and hand for a body, preparing to flick the earth away. This is a very collectible version. Even the bootleg of this German release is highly collectible.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow,
and,
okay.
Another story is that before he was relieved of his duties, Ken Pitt, Bowie's manager at the time, set about trying to secure the services of world-famous artists to provide the cover for The Man Who Sold the World. So it gets even more ridiculous.
Yeah.
The shortlist included Andy Warhol and David Hockney. Now, shortlists are dead easy, aren't they?
Of course they are.
You just get a pen and a piece of paper and you write down a shortlist.
Yeah.
But getting Andy Warhol, who we know was deeply unimpressed with Ken Pitt anyway, and didn't seem hugely impressed with David Bowie further down the line, little chance, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1972, the worldwide reissue by RCA, as just mentioned, used the black and white picture of Ziggy, referred to as the kicking cover. This image remained the cover art on reissues until 1990, when Rykodisc released decided to reinstate the dress cover, and the dress cover has appeared on subsequent reissues of the album, as it should do, because that is the true cover, in my eyes, anyway.
Absolutely. So, The Man Who Sold the World was generally more successful commercially and critically in the US than in the UK when it was finally released. Melody Maker and Enemy found it surprisingly excellent and rather hysterical, respectively.
Surprisingly excellent. Damn by faint praise. John Mendelsohn of the Rolling Stone called the album uniformly excellent and commented that Tony Visconti's use of echo, phasing and other techniques on Bowie's voice serves to reinforce the jaggedness of Bowie's words and music, which he interpreted as oblique and fragmented images that are almost impenetrable separately, but which convey with effectiveness an ironic and bitter sense of the world when considered together.
Paid by the word, then.
Yes.
Sales were not high enough to dent the charts in either country at the time. However, it made number 26 in the UK and number 105 in the US following its re-release on the 25th of November 1972 in the wake of the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. The Man Who Sold the World has since been cited as inspiring the goth rock, dark wave and science fiction elements of work by artists such as Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, Gary Numan, John Fox and Nine Inch Nails.
In his journal, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana listed it at number 45 in his top 50 favourite albums. And of course, in 1993, Nirvana covered The Man Who Sold the World's title track for their TV special MTV Unplugged in New York. It's also been claimed that glam rock began with the release of this album, though it's also attributed to Mark Boland's appearance on Top of the Pops in December 1970, wearing glitter to perform what would be his first UK hit under T-Rex name Rider White Swan.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
So let's look at the album track by track. So Width of a Circle, it's the opening track of the album, and it's a really amazing, heavy rocking... what is it, Bob? I mean, it's riff-tastic.
Well, it's definitely prog, isn't it? You know, it is huge.
It is huge, and it's a monolith, and Mick Ronson's guitar playing is amazing. In fact, the whole band sound amazing on this record. That's what needs saying, and we'll get through to the live performances in a short while. But yeah, just amazing. Featuring Mick Ronson's lead guitar work and occasional choral effects from the band. This 8-minute song is divided into two parts. The music takes on heavy R&B quality in the second half, where the narrator enjoys a sexual encounter with God or the devil or some other supernatural being, according to different interpretations, in the depths of hell.
So Bowie was getting heavy here lyrically, wasn't he? Certainly.
Yeah, okay, so he swallowed his pride and puckered his lips.
And showed me the leather belt round his hips.
My knees were shaking, my cheeks aflame.
He said, you'll never go down to the gods again.
Turn around, go back.
He struck the ground, a cavern appeared.
And I smelt the burning pit of fear.
We crashed 1,000 yards below.
I said, do it again, do it again.
Turn around, go back.
His nebulous body swayed above.
His tongue swollen with devil's love.
A snake and I, a venom high.
I said, do it again, do it again.
Turn around, go back.
Breathe, breathe, breathe deeply.
As I was seething, breathing deeply.
Spitting sentry, horned and tailed.
Waiting for you. So, I mean, it is strange, isn't it? Because if you look at the influences on Bowie's career and the fact that he'd been through the mod thing and all different parts of his career. And as we know, Lionel Bart and Anthony Newley, he'd just gone through his kind of folky phase with the Art Slab and Dylan-esque dabblings.
Mm.
But this is like informed by stuff like Aleister Crowley and Nietzsche.
Isn't it?
Which we'll have a bit more of a look at that in a short while. So on to All the Mad Men.
Yeah, track two, one of a number of tunes on the album dealing with insanity. It's been described as depicting a world so bereft of reason that the last sane men are the ones in the asylums. And the tune itself opens with acoustic guitar and recorder before transforming into a heavy rocker featuring distorted guitar chords from Ronson and also Moog synth played by Ralph Mace. It ends with the chant Zane, 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 ouvre le chien, which is the latter phrase literally means open the dog. In French.
And it's the only French that I know.
Oh.
So the production of the song also made use of vari-speed vocals, which Bowie had used before, but only on the Laughing Gnome, which was for a completely different effect. That was in 1967.
Yeah.
And Bowie had said that the song was written for and about his half-brother, Terry. Terry just raising his head there.
Mm.
And the lyrics include references to lobotomy, the tranquilizer Librium, and EST, which is also electroshock therapy, and which is a controversial treatment for some types of deep depression and mental illness.
So All the Mad Men was released by Mercury in edited form as a promo single featuring the same tune on both sides in America in December 1970, prior to Bowie going over there to do his promo work in early 71. An official release featuring Janine, which is from this previous album, as the B-side, is thought to have been planned but shelved, and a handful of stock copies have been found. So in June 1973, RCA Records, which had reissued the song's parent album the previous year, issued All the Mad Men as a single in Eastern Europe, backed with Soul Love from the Ziggy Stardust album.
It's weird, isn't it? Because, I mean, they're just plucking anything that they like to pair it up.
It seems so random, doesn't it, all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't be allowed now, put it that way. Okay, so on to track three, which is Black Country Rock. So, as well as appearing on the album, it was also issued as a B-side to Bowie's January 1971 single, Holy Holy. And its style has been compared to Mark Bolan's contemporary Tyrannosaurus Rex, down to Bowie's vibrato in the final verse.
According to Tony Visconti, Bowie had the music ready by the start of the sessions, but the words were a last-minute addition in the studio. The singer, doing his Bolan impression spontaneously, said Visconti, because he ran out of lyrics. We all think it was cool, so it stayed. Fair enough.
He's very, very transparently Bolan, isn't he?
Certainly. lovely, very much. So we move on to After All now, which is one of a number of Bowie tunes from the early 70s, from that time, reflecting the influence of Nietzsche and also Aleister Crowley, as you just mentioned. It's been described by biographer David Buckley as the album's hidden gem. Nicholas Pegg calls it one of Bowie's most underrated recordings. And the song's been interpreted as taking to nightmarish conclusions the children's world of Bowie's early tune, There Is a Happy Land, from his debut in 1967. So there are threads to the past here, aren't there? In, you know, however tenuous.
Are. Yeah, I mean, most artists did that. I mean, if you look at, look no further than Lou Reed, who was a master of it, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Because the records that he made from 1970, in his solo style, was always made up of just a ragtag kind of things that he'd had stored away, done demos for, half-written songs and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, Bowie had a massive back catalogue to run out of songs, didn't he, that he'd racked up behind him. Okay, so the track is unusual in a rock context for being in a waltz time, most obviously in the surreal circus-like instrumental break. Its style was inspired by the slightly sinister, measured melancholy of songs Bowie recalled from childhood, such as Danny Kaye's Inchworm, which again we've discussed before.
Yeah.
Regarding the music's arrangement, producer Tony Visconti said, the basic song and the Oh By Jingo line were David's ideas. The rest was Ronno and me vying for the next overdub, which is great. You know, this is very... and Woody said exactly the same thing. And it reminds me a little bit of the band Cream. Now, we know that Mick Ronson was mad on Cream.
Yeah.
And they notoriously, when they would be playing live particularly, they would just wait for a little crack of light to shine through so that they could jump in and do their own solo. So, you know, it was like a competition. So
yeah,
Eric Clapton would be firing away, doing one of his solos. Now, and if he just took a little breather, Ginger Baker would be off doing a drum solo and with Jack Bruce looking on thinking, me next.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. That was one of the reasons why Cream split, wasn't it? Because they were all, it just became a competition on stage.
Right, okay. Well, Woody said that. He said that this album was a great opportunity for them both to show off because, I mean, they'd not really done much recording before, had they?
So,
kids in a sweet shop.
Definitely. Okay, so we move on to Running Gun Blues now, which is a bit of an odd one, isn't it? Nicholas Pegg in The Complete David Bowie describes it as taking an unusually direct lyrical line. Bowie assumes the persona of a deranged Vietnam War veteran who indulges in a killing spree at home. There'd been similar real-life atrocities in America around that time, so it's likely the song was a reflection of all that.
Right, okay. So, the words are pretty grim, actually.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah, but I'll slip out again tonight because they haven't taken back my rifle, for I promote oblivion and I'll plug a few civilians.
Yeah, it's really dark, isn't it? So move on to Saviour Machine.
Okay, mate. So again, courtesy of Nick Pegg's book, apparently Bowie finished the lyrics to Saviour Machine in the early hours of the morning after being pushed by Visconti to get it finished. It's a dystopian tale which preempts the bleak world of Diamond Dogs. It really does. And it's a tale of the power hungry and those happy to follow them blindly.
Okay, it is an amazing tune, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it.
She Shook Me Cold, another melodramatic piece. Mick Ronson's solo guitar influenced by Cream, Led Zeppelin, and of course, Jeff Beck, who's his big hero. Working title of this tune was Suck, and its title bears a resemblance to the Muddy Waters tune You Shook Me, recorded by Jeff Beck for the then recent album Truth.
Okay, so this was described again by Nick Pegg as competent early 70s rock, but it's hardly a David Bowie song at all. Now, Nick knows he's Bowie. He's a massive Bowie fan, and that book of his is just incredible.
It is.
And it gets updated, you know, all the time, and I've got loads of different versions of it. But I have to disagree on this particular occasion. I mean, I know that he says here that it's a little more than a swaggering rock and roll boast about sexual conquest with a little occult nastiness thrown in.
Okay.
Great! What more could you want, really?
Exactly,
And I think it's just a really, really great song. I just love the riffing on it. So, each to their own, eh?
Completely. Of course, you know. So, The Man Who Sold the World, now the title track. So, in common with a number of tunes on the album, the song's themes have been compared to the horror fantasy works of H.P. Lovecraft, and the lyrics also cited as reflecting Bowie's concerns with splintered or multiple personalities, believed to have been partially inspired by a poem by William Hughes Mearns called Antagonish. In the BBC Radio 1 special programme Changes Now Bowie, which was broadcast in January 1997, Bowie was interviewed by Marianne Hobbs and was asked about this tune. He said, I guess I wrote it because there's a part of myself that I was looking for. Maybe now that I feel more comfortable with the way that I live my life and my mental state, and he's kind of laughing slightly here, wasn't he? And my spiritual state, whatever, maybe I feel there's some kind of unity now.
Yeah, he went on to say, that song for me always exemplified kind of how you feel when you're young, when you know that there's a piece of yourself that you haven't really put together yet. You have this great searching, this great need to find out who you really are. And so Bowie was obviously still scratching around. And this is an interesting point. We were talking about it before, weren't we, Bob? But if you look at The Man Who Sold the World, and then you look at Ziggy Stardust, you can see just the moving on of the career, can't you? You can see the step from one to the other.
Yeah.
But when you put Hunky Dory into the middle of it, it just throws it completely. I often say that the release of the Radiohead albums would seem chronologically wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because you can see the way that they're going, and then it just takes a few little diversions and comes back on board again. And with this, if you were to look at the Rock album, where they're still trying to find the feet, the band have just got together, and they've got an idea of what they want to do, but they've not really harnessed it into any kind of a feasible commercial outlet.
Yeah.
Okay, but you do it, and it's a great, great record. Like I say, I absolutely love it. And then it all comes together, and you've got the perfect package in Ziggy Stardust. In the middle of that, you've got this amazing singer-songwriter album.
That's the thing.
Which, as we know, he recorded Hunky Dory and then forgot it pretty much as soon as he'd done it, because he was into recording Ziggy Stardust even before Hunky Dory was out. But yeah, it's just, it is weird. If some aliens were to come down and put David Bowie's albums from, 1970 to 1980, in what would they consider to be the chronological order, they would pretty much get it wrong, I would say.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, had Hunky Dory not been there, it's possible to draw a line in it from Man Who Sold the World right through to Diamond Dogs, definitely.
Or even if you look at the fact that if it was to follow on from Space Oddity,
yeah,
that would have made sense.
Yeah.
You know, because with all the epic and the epic songs on Space Oddity, you could see that leading into Life on Mars and Boulet Brothers and Quicksand and all that, and then, yeah, okay, you're getting onto this rock tip, you know, but obviously that's not the way that it happened.
And that's one of the reasons, of course, why we love him, isn't it? We've also mentioned in L, Lulu doing a cover of The Man Who Sold the World. Midge Ure did it as well, didn't he, in 1982?
That passed me by, to be honest.
I missed that as well, but apparently it's on the Party original motion picture soundtrack. We've also mentioned the fact that Nirvana did it. It was a big favourite of Kurt Cobain's.
Bowie was really made up about this, wasn't he? And we know that Bowie really loved it when young bands would pay homage to him, you know? And you could tell that even bands that were obviously influenced by him, like Suede, you know? And so there was that Enemy cover photo with Brett Anderson and Placebo and Smashing Pumpkins, all these bands who would say, yeah, we love David Bowie. It thrilled Bowie, that, because, and I think that, you know, it's a strange one really, but I also think that he liked coming on the Radio 1 programme with Mark Radcliffe and I, because we were the last bastion of Bowie nuts at Radio 1. And so if it hadn't been for Radcliffe and I, he would have been designated a Radio 2 artist, and he really, really wouldn't have wanted that. No offence to Radio 2.
No.
And so that's why he would come and visit us regularly on the programme, because, you know, he wanted to be part of something not seen to be, past it, you know? And, and almost looking at a different audience there, a more mature audience. And so when Nirvana did it, he was absolutely made up, and he said, I was simply blown away when I found out that Kurt Cobain liked my work, and I've always wanted to talk to him about his reasons for covering The Man Who Sold the World, and that it was a good straightforward rendition and sounded somehow very honest. It would have been nice to have worked with him, but just talking with him would have been real cool.
Oh wow, nice.
And he also said that he thought that the cover was heartfelt, and he said that until this cover, it hadn't occurred to me that I was part of America's musical landscape. I always felt my weight in Europe, but not in the US.
That seems like such a remarkable thing to say, doesn't it? All the success he'd had by that point.
Yeah, but it is strange, you know. I mean, it's often that Milli Vanilli fact, if it is a fact, the line being that the first Milli Vanilli album, or the big one, sold more than David Bowie's entire back catalogue in America up to that point, you know. But he had number ones and was an icon, but yeah.
All right. So in the wake of its release, Bowie bemoaned the fact that when he performed at the number himself, he would encounter kids that come up afterwards and say, hey, it's cool you're doing a Nirvana song. And I think, F you little tosser. That must have driven him nuts, really. On the 14th of February 2016, surviving Nirvana band members Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl and Pat Smear turned up with Beck to perform The Man Who Sold the World at a pre-Grammy Awards party, in tribute to Bowie, of course, with Beck performing the vocals.
And in 2017, to mark what would have been Kurt Cobain's 50th birthday, the Phonographic Performance Limited released a list of the top 20 most played Nirvana songs on TV and radio in the UK, in which The Man Who Sold the World was ranked at number 6.
Okay.
And they also did a louder, rockier version of it as well.
All right. So the Supermen, this is one of my favourites. Also one of a number of pieces on the album inspired by Nietzsche and H.P. Lovecraft. Been cited as reflecting the influence of German Romanticism, theme and lyrics reflecting the apocalyptic visions of Nietzsche. Bowie said later, "I was still going through the thing when I was pretending that I understood Nietzsche and I tried to translate it into my own terms to understand it." So Supermen came out of that. Critics have also seen the influence of H.P. Lovecraft's stories of dormant elder gods.
This is really interesting, actually. According to Bowie, the actual riff for the song was given to him, gifted to him, whoa, by Jimmy Page when they were at a recording session for I Pity the Fool, which was being produced by Shel Talmy.
Wow.
And I had heard this before, and it also tips up again in Dead Man Walking, but yeah, apparently Jimmy Page was playing it in the studio and Bowie said, "Oh, I really like that riff," and Jimmy Page says, "I don't know what to do with it, really. You can have it."
Wow, and he took it.
He did, but he didn't give Jimmy Page a credit, and you would wonder whether Jimmy Page was saying, yeah, you can use it if you want, but
yeah.
Obviously, again, we weren't there, but he didn't get a credit anyway.
Okay.
But, you know, looking at this album, it's, you know, one of those albums that never really got a proper outing live, did it?
Well, they didn't really tour it, did they?
No, I mean, the closest that they ever got was the few gigs that their Hype did.
Yeah.
Okay, there's also the story about Bowie. We've touched on it before, particularly from Tony Visconti, saying that Bowie had to be cajoled into contributing to the album because he was so besotted with his new wife, Angie.
That's right. I mean, we know, of course, don't we, that Mick Ronson had a sort of formal education in composing and arranging, and this is where he really comes through as a force. So his contributions, you know, they can't be kind of over-exaggerated, can they? Under the guidance, has to be said, of Tony Visconti, who's learning from all the time. And so, you know, this story that Bowie didn't really do much was refuted by Ralph Mace, who played on the Moog. And he sort of gave Bowie the benefit of the doubt. He said he was more involved than others have actually suggested. And he said what he wanted, he knew what he wanted and what he didn't want. So there was this sort of grey area in the middle. And he said it was a case of the others trying to get there. And then as soon as Bowie sort of had this sort of almost this elusive thing in his head that he could identify all of a sudden, then he knew he had a song. So it's a strange way of making an album, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And let's face it, the band were new together, weren't they?
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
So they were kind of finding the feet, really. And again, living in poverty and all that kind of stuff. So it was a strange time for Bowie. He described the whole recording scenario for The Man Who Sold the World as a nightmare. And he's saying it was recorded when I was at my most up. Mm-hmm. Holding on to some kind of flag for hashish. Though again, just conversely, the other band members don't back this story up at all.
No.
So Bowie is like giving off the story that he was just stoned all the time and the band were going, well, he wasn't. So,
well, there were a lot of changes, weren't there? I mean, it's been like, you know, obviously in Bowie's life, because his dad had died not long before, mm. and, Angie was there, just got married, and he was missing his dad terribly, still troubled by Terry's situation, of course, and he would be, you know, reflected in the lyrics, you know, worried about his own mental state and the rest of it. At the same time, you know, the hippie movement had really gone. It was the start of a new era. So it was changes. Everything was, it seemed to be in flux, and Bowie was in flux too, wasn't he, I think?
Yeah, you'd have to wonder as well, who introduced David Bowie to the works of Aleister Crowley and Nietzsche and also Cahill Gibran as well.
Ah.
I mean, you know, so these things, that they had a massive impact on Bowie's writing, didn't they? And lest we forget, you know, Holy Holy, right? We need to talk about the band Holy Holy, which in essence is Woody Woodmansey and Tony Visconti and Glenn Gregory.
Yeah.
And we've also got in there just the amazing dual guitars of Paul Cudderford and James Stevenson.
That's right, yeah.
And very other people have been involved as well, you know, Terry Edwards and yeah, lots of different people.
Mm.
But I've seen Holy Holy twice, okay? And they did the two different tours. And the first tour that I saw was them doing The Man Who Sold the World.
Whoa.
And I have to say, it was jaw-dropping. I didn't know what to expect, and I have been to see one David Bowie tribute band and I lasted 10 minutes. I just can't
really?
Abide. I don't
right.
like tribute bands anyway, but seeing somebody trying to emulate Bowie and not nailing it, it's just, it didn't work for me personally, though it seems to be quite popular these days. But you have to say Glenn Gregory is amazing because he can reach all of those notes, he can sing it and pull it off brilliantly, but he doesn't try and impersonate Bowie, which was crucial.
That's the thing, is because I didn't see the Man Who Sold the World tour itself, but I saw them doing the Ziggy tour in which they played a couple of tunes from The Man Who Sold the World, and I'm going into it, I was thinking, oh, I just hope he's not trying to do a bit of a kind of Stars in Your Eyes thing and be Bowie, and he didn't. You know, to his credit, he was brilliant and a great, really charismatic frontman. The way he fronted those tunes was just spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, do you know, I heard years ago that there was some talk of a Bowie act coming out on the road with Woody Woodmansey and Trevor Boulder.
Right.
Now, Now, of course, sadly, Trevor Boulder passed away. And so, if this is the way that it all transpired, I'm guessing that then it was thought, right, well, Tony Visconti, you know, is an obvious go-to man as well, which then gave them the opportunity to go out for the first time and perform this album in its entirety and brilliantly, but sadly without David Bowie.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at the original rhythm section from that album doing it, it was just jaw-dropping. I love the Ziggy show as well. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
But watching everything was just completely nailed on, you know, and it was absolutely brilliant. And I think they're doing it again, actually.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? I mean, it must have been so liberating for Woody and Tony Visconti to do that as well, because it really is stuff that you can get your teeth into as a musician, I would imagine. Much as I love Ziggy, of course, you know, the material itself is overly familiar. So when they went into stuff like With the Circle and the rest, that was, for me, the standout stuff, because they're just begging to be played live.
And, you know, being a bit of a spod, as I know you are as well, Bob.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking, right, okay, well, I'm watching these songs being performed here by the people who performed it originally. That was really important, you know. And obviously Trevor Boulder was on Ziggy Stardust, so it made a slight difference. But, I just have to say that anybody who's not seen Holy Holy, I personally would just thoroughly recommend it. And if they're doing The Man Who Sold the World, then move heaven and earth to get there.
Go see him.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley, recorded and edited by Howard Nock, with social media graphics by Jason Reed. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode,
The Manish Boys,
Mary Hopkin, Main Man, Mr. Fish.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.